Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Writing the Rapids, the show where I, Joe Balecki, talk to writers about writing. Very often, those writers have been recommended to me by writers who have previously been on the show. In the case of today's guest, Thomas Kendall, he was recommended to me by David Leo Rice. Thomas is the author of The Autodidacts from 2022, out from Whiskey Tit Books, and How I Killed the Universal Man from 2023, also out through Whiskey Tit Books. Before we get into my conversation with Thomas, let me tell you about how you can support the show. For just $2 a month, you can become a patron at patreon.com/noisemakerjoe. You'll get these episodes about a day earlier than everybody else. Or you can buy my book. It's called Tired. It's on Amazon. You can buy the book Unheimlich, which is a compilation of suburban horror, which has an excerpt from Tired in it that is out through Soyos Books. Or, heck, just find me on social media, rate the show 5 stars on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, share it with a friend, that sort of thing. Now, without any further ado, let's get into my conversation with Thomas. One of the first things I noticed about How I Killed the Universal Man was this idea of emotions or ideas being forced upon you. One of the things I highlighted was that Lakerman's eyes well up involuntarily during a scene where I think he's seeing an advertisement, maybe. And in another part of the novel, he wonders if he's consented to some of the knowledge that he's gotten. And I find that really interesting. It reminds me of a conversation I had with one of my friends a couple years ago about billboards on the highway. And some study he had read or paper he had read about how all these bright colors of the billboards that you see while you're driving kind of like force your eye to them and force you to read them. And rugged individualist that I am, I was like, no, man, if I see a billboard, I make sure not to buy that product until I forget about the billboard or whatever. I mean, most of the time I see an advertisement and it's not something for me at all. So I think I was just being younger and dumber. But, you know, the sort of cyberpunk neon noir world of How I Killed the Universal Man, the technology has gotten more aggressive. And that's an interesting theme, I think. The idea that, like, not only is information being screamed at you, but it's, like, causing you to react before you even notice.
Yeah, yeah. I think exactly that kind of idea, really. I've always been sort of interested in this idea between like what the sort of qualitative difference is between a reflex or a reaction and like what is a sort of genuine thought. And I remember, seeing a bad film in the cinema and the music kind of swells up and like, you know, I'd be sort of physically sort of affected by it while sort of cynically going, this is just, you know, this is awful or trite. And then my body is sort of reacting in a way that is kind of conditioned in some sense. And similarly, I think those emotions or those kind of things, a real kind of thought. Sorry, I'm being very unclear. This is it's going to be a habit with me, I'm afraid. But I remember reading also, you know, with like neurosurgery or stuff, you can stimulate a part of the brain and you'll laugh, no? And you'll be an involuntary laugh, but it's not a real laughter, no? You don't have the experience or the internal kind of state that comes with the joy of release. So that aspect of kind of what is like the qualitative effect of something that is not engineered versus kind of the engineering of an emotion, and then also kind of how that relates to kind of narrative and context, and how, you know, narrative is always kind of part of the emotion that's kind of in there, and yet at the same time it's so frequently kind of abused. So that it was just a kind of interesting notion that kind of came up as I was kind of writing, and it's yeah, it's one of the more central themes, I think, of the book.
Yeah. And it certainly increases, I think, as the book goes on, as he gets more implants, as more drugs are injected and ingested, to the point where at some point the book shifts into second person and for a little bit. And yeah, I think, to that point, the merging of drugs and technology in the book was really interesting to me too. I guess sometimes when I think about science fiction or future tech or whatever, everything's very mechanical. But the idea of mixing that mechanical stuff with, I don't know, new age designer drugs, you know, based off of, I don't know, however many years of like research into psychedelics and stuff, that it makes sense that there would be new drugs and that those drugs would interact with certain physical augmentations and create new experiences.
Yeah, I think like one of the big inspirations, one of the things that kind of really got me thinking about sort of the novel or the plot and this aspect of it to begin with, I went to see an exhibition by Haroon Farrokhi, and it was called Serious Games, and it was about the use of VR in virtual reality therapy for kind of soldiers who had come back from the war. And part of the exhibition was kind of like a documentary where they were recreating the scenario or the point of kind of trauma for this soldier. And then, you know, so they would go through, and the idea was by kind of this virtual reality repetition, it would act as a way to de-escalate or manage the kind of emotion. So I was thinking about that. And then obviously, you know, so many of us are, you know, we take antidepressants or we are very kind of medicalized in general. And so it just seems like that is an area where things will possibly at some point converge, or there's kind of possibilities within virtual spaces for biological reactions and maybe places in biological reactions for virtual experiences. So yeah, trying to think about that, and also trying to sort of wonder if there, yeah, whether there could also be some aspect of positive outcome between those kind of mingling, and where, you know, trying to maintain it without it being just overtly sort of judgmental, I think is part of the difficulty of doing something like that. Because if it's just kind of, you know, oh, this is, you know, just awful, then you kind of lose the possibility of like, or what's interesting about it as well, I think. But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think it's really easy, especially these days. I had to X out of like 6 different new, do you want to try our AI assistant, just starting up my computer today for the first time in a couple weeks. And yeah, it's very easy to be cynical about it, but like, you know, technology can make things better.
It could.
The wheel made it easier to get water to the village. Certainly you can, you know, use future nanobot LSD to heal your inner child.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. I think the state of kind of AI and sort of assets today are kind of horrific, what we're seeing with it, and the sort of environmental impact of it is, you know, at the moment it's very much a kind of a swindle, I think.
God, yes.
And then like working in school, like seeing how often now it's being kind of used for like essays and things, and how immediately easy it is to spot, at the moment at least.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's not, I hope the sort of notion of AI or the idea behind it in the novel is, yeah, I hope it's sort of working up at both ends in a way. I don't know if that makes sense, but yeah, it is, I know, sort of a tricky tricky area at the moment.
Yeah, I do think it is incumbent to keep a level head about the technology itself, and see like what's a good example? Like rocketry, right? Like rockets for war, bad. Rockets for space exploration, maybe not so bad. At some point, there's going to be a lot of humans. Population control doesn't sound so great. We got a whole universe out there. Maybe some people might want to be out there. There's lots of good materials, you know, in space rocks. Maybe mining some of those out there so we don't have to do it in, like, South America or Africa. Might be nice, right? You get somebody well paid out there, and maybe your iPhone costs a little bit more, but hey, you're not hollowing out the Earth, you're hollowing out an asteroid, and that's not quite so Disney-fied. We got a couple generations before you have asteroid activists talking about the natural gravitational beauty of the asteroid belt or something. But yeah, that was a long walk and my feet hurt, but I guess my point is, and I think there is some of this in the book, that purely looking at what people are doing with the technology right now, and then therefore passing moral judgment on the technology itself, is, I think, creatively stifling in a way that makes me feel kind of disappointed when I see creatives do it. Even though I understand the emotion behind it, right? It's almost the same thing, right? You keep seeing articles about how terrible AI is, and it forces you to say AI is bad. There's no possible way that you could ever do anything positively creative with it, because The Guardian had a dumb op-ed or something.
Yeah, I think it's very bizarre for me to sort of sit here and kind of talk, because I'm not really from a sort of science background, or even kind of, I didn't expect to write a sort of science fiction book. Mm. When I started How I Killed the Universal Man, you know, it was, you know, I'm quite a slow writer, and it was quite a few years before, you know, ChatGPT or kind of this kind of massive explosion that we've seen recently of it was. So it's quite strange. So my sort of experience or knowledge of kind of AI came from reading some different accounts of, like, you know, the birth of, I can't remember what it was. I think it's I can't remember the title, How He Became Posthuman or something. And it's like all about Norbert Wiener and this big conference of like cybernetics at the time. And then I was reading a few, like, just trying to do some research, and I saw this, like, I think it was sponsored by Facebook, where they were trying to translate, you know, this was kind of, I think, a key example where we see these two kind of things merge. There was a scientific study I was reading about where they were trying to translate the thoughts of paraplegics, so that they would be able to operate certain things and be able to communicate. Fantastic, incredibly worthwhile, beautiful investment of money. This is, you know, and then you see that this study is sort of sponsored by Facebook, and you sort of spiral thinking about, well, what exactly, you know, what other possible motives are there? And so it becomes kind of ethically murky. And at the same time, like, all those kind of interfaith faces, they're always double in some way. You know, there's always some element how they can be kind of used. I've really gone off really gone off track.
Yeah. It's the old meme. You don't hate Mondays, Garfield, you hate capitalism.
Yeah.
And I would encourage people, especially with AI, you don't hate AI, you hate capitalism. What was the other thing? To that point, I think part of it for me is I promised myself as a young kid that I would never lose touch with technology the way that it felt to me the older generation my parents and grandparents had. Like, it really seemed like they could work a DVD player, but they couldn't get their computer to work. And I was like, I'm never gonna let myself do that. I'm never gonna like get to a point and stop. So I'm always gonna be abreast of what the technology is, even if I'm not an early adopter. I'm always gonna understand how it works. And I think maybe that's kept like rose-colored glasses on me a little bit too much, where what I'm seeing is being interpreted by the child inside of me as just like my generation becoming old. And it's like, no, guys, you're complaining that, you know, VCRs are going to kill the movie industry or whatever. Like, this is the same tone I'm reading. And obviously there's a lot more to it. You know, the people complaining that VCRs were going to kill the movie industry were worried that they were going to lose out on making money. And the people who are mad about AI are worried that they're going to lose their jobs and are already people who aren't making tons of money. So it's different, but it feels emotionally to, you know, 10-year-old Joe kind of the same. The other thing, too, that I think about is because of my interest in tech as a young kid, I used to listen to tech news podcasts all the time when podcasts were new. And a common refrain that I heard was, if something on the internet is free, you are the product. And I feel like for a lot of people, they're kind of just figuring that out, or maybe they're figuring out the extent to which that is true. And yeah, there is a difference between, there's ads on Facebook because I don't have to subscribe to Facebook, and getting to my car is sending the data about how I drive to my car insurance people so they can charge me more. There is a disconnect there because I bought the car. I paid all the money for the car. I don't need to be the product. The car is the product. So yeah, there's a lot there. One of the things I read, sort of changing topics now, but maybe not, in your interview that you did with Rebecca on X-Ray, was the starting out with this from a noir perspective, which is something I really appreciate because I really like that genre flavor of noir. I like taking somebody who's kind of low and just shoving them down more. And so I would like to hear you talk about noir a little bit.
Okay. I think of all kinds of genres, I think noir is, like, for me, the most, like, aesthetically beautiful. No, every kind of noir film I've sort of seen, even down to, you know, the kind of, you know, all of the generic elements are just generally, they work for me every time, and they work for me even when they're sort of appropriated. And because I think they tap into kind of, I'm always interested in kind of how we sort of tolerate not knowing, and sort of how not knowing is really can drive kind of, you know, the desire or the kind of structure or as a kind of motivation, and what that kind of opens up the possibilities to kind of think about. So I guess kind of, yeah, noir, and especially because with How I Killed the Universal Man, one of the sort of rules I kind of have for it is I wanted it to have kind of a lot of the traditional pleasures of kind of plot, which is something that I hadn't kind of worked with or tried to do so much. And the only way I could sort of, you know, the only kind of really kind of plot driven work that I've enjoyed and which I think I can, you know, kind of marry to my interest is kind of noir. Because you kind of see noir, you see it in like Alain Robert, I'm probably going to pronounce his name right, de Grillet or something, The Erasers, you see it in kind of David Lynch, you can see kind of noir from the 40s. It just has a kind of, because it's so perfectly stylized, it's so aesthetically kind of like you know, it's stylized from the outset. So it really kind of, you know, transplants well, and you can play with it, and it's still the structure is still recognizably interesting. And because at its heart is like the idea of some kind of insoluble truth. And even if you get to kind of what that truth is, the way that, you know, the way whatever is sort of the toxicity of kind of of what's emanating out of the truth is really more interesting. So there's always a kind of outward movement, though. You have kind of one realization in noir, and that's kind of broken by a larger ripple until like eventually like you're in this kind of macrocosmic you know thing in which there's no possible way to kind of comprehend. I think it's kind of like, if working within kind of plot or trying to do it, it's for me like the only way that I could conceive of kind of figuring out how to write the novel, I think.
Yeah. Hearing you explain it like that, it's Lovecraftian in a way, right? Like the more knowledge you get, the deeper into the insanity you go.
I think there are sort of parallels with like all the cosmic horror stuff with it.
Yeah. That's an interesting realization I've just had, and I'm now very excited to think about that. One of the things I like about noir stories and How I Killed the Universal Man is how it's hard for me to know what's going on a lot of the time. Especially, I think, in How I Killed the Universal Man, because there is a, you know, an element of hallucinogens happening and nanobots transmitting information into Lakerman's brain, that it's, you know, it's like surreal and hallucinatory. While all this information is coming in, it's hard to know what information is real and what information is useful and what to do with that information, which I think also just is how being on the internet in 2024 works.
Yeah. You know, I think one of the sort of slight in joke with the novel is a lot of the sort of interruptions or the kind of spamming with information that he gets are sort of, you know, Wikipedia articles or aspects of it. So it's not even necessarily that the information is always of like a high grade. With the sort of the destabilizing, that's the reason why I think, again, the kind of noir framing kind of helps, because I'm very aware that I find it quite hard to sort of localize things or to sketch out a kind of narrative in which, you know, I find it difficult, and I'm not always that interested in sort of writing it, so it makes it doubly difficult. Because it's a similar thing, I think, with the autodidacts. There's always, I need some notion of kind of mystery or some element of that in order to kind of make the other things function, because where am I going with this? Sorry about this. I've completely gone blank.
That's okay. I was wondering, you know, based on what you were just saying, if that is something that you desire as a reader, and so you're writing it, or if it's something you need as a writer to stay interested.
I think it's something I enjoy a lot in other fiction, and I kind of look for that. I'm not, do you know what I mean? I think the ability or kind of the, or at least my sort of tastes in kind of literature probably go towards that a certain amount of kind of not knowing or confusion, or how you can deal with how uncomfortable you are with sort of not knowing or being confused, and sort of being able to go, okay, I don't know what this, I have no idea what this means at the moment, but there's something in here that I want to sort of pursue. Yeah, I need that in kind of one I'm writing, and I look for it when I'm kind of reading books, not to kind of, I don't mind the feeling that the book, another book is kind of pursuing something, or that it's trying to get somewhere or work something out if that's the kind of the motor of the book for me, that's, you know, I really enjoy that in general.
Okay. Yeah, I get that. I think when one of the big frustrations, and I feel like I've talked about this a lot, and it goes back to me, like, as a child trying to write fantasy stories, is like plotting has always kind of been my enemy, because if I can summarize the story very easily on like one page, then my brain just imagines, my brain just fills in the gaps, right? It's like, oh, there's battles, yeah, and there's a love story, and I can see the trees of the landscape the characters are traveling through. I don't need to write it. I got the story in my head now. Like, I'm done. Which, you know, is fine for a day of daydreaming, but not as someone who wants to have books out in the world. So, up until fairly recently, my writing practice has just sort of been like, start with an image and see where it goes, which presents its own equal and opposite challenges too. And to that point, I wonder, do you find yourself getting stuck as a writer, kind of like on the same stumbling blocks?
Oh, all the time. All the time. I think both books I had to basically trash and restart after finishing like the first draft. Like, no, nothing remained. Mm-hmm. The day was just like, oh, this doesn't work. And I've spent like a year and a half, and it's totally incomprehensible to anybody that isn't me. I hope, I think maybe because How I Killed the Universe Man is quite sort of different in its approach than the other text, I've kind of maybe learned how to speed up the process slightly. I hope that's the case. I'm not going to have to go through the same thing again. Now I think I am more aware of when the writing gets too internalized, because that's definitely sort of my tendency, is to, you know, wallow in something abstract for a few pages, which, you know, hopefully has, you know, the parts that do that now, hopefully they are in the correct place where they can do that interestingly. But, you know, given, if I wasn't sort of, or at least with the autodidacts, I would write pages and pages, and, you know, at some point it just loses impact and it's not interesting for anybody else. And it's, yeah, the same. I'm also, you know, I start with a kind of image or an idea, and I have no notion really where the story is kind of going. And then I have to kind of relentlessly kind of rework everything or rework a sentence. And yeah, I don't really know how it happens. Just eventually there's a book after.
Sure. Do you enjoy that reworking process?
Yeah, I mean, I just really enjoy the act of kind of writing, or kind of, I think there are times when you're up against a wall and you don't know where to go next, or you think the decision, that's, you know, I kind of tend to put those those sort of decisions off. But the actual act of writing or kind of working on parts is, yeah, it's like the most the most enjoyable activity. But there are things that are very frustrating when you're just like, I don't know, how do you get across the room and why? Mm-hmm. Kind of, like, why do you get out of the chair? I don't know.
Yeah. I find myself struggling with editing so much, especially novels, because it's like, oh God, there's so much here. There's so much text. I mean, the Autodidacts is a long book.
yeah.
And, you know, I struggle looking at a document that's like 50,000 words and being like, oh God, how do I connect what's on page 2 to what's on page 40 thematically? And how do I keep it all straight in my brain? I mean, I used to say that I charismaed my way through school by just learning to be a very good first draft writer for school papers, because they'd be like, we're going to give you 2 weeks because we want you to go through 4 drafts. And I'd just be like, no, I'm going to write one draft and I'm going to just do it correctly. Which has made my adult writing for fun life very difficult, because I don't have that muscle. I don't have the, you know, I don't know how to keep everybody's eye color the same throughout the book or whatever.
Yeah, I know. I mean, if it helps, I'm so slow that I'll be working on like a paragraph for a month or just rewriting the same paragraph, not even trying, you know? So yeah, I think it's like with editing, it's not like I produce a lot and then I'm like, oh yes, now I can go back and make it good. It's like, I've written 5 sentences and you know, this first word is okay. So that's not, it takes so long that I'm, you know, I wonder if I'll ever be able to do it again, to be honest. Right.
Yeah. I suppose I see it. I'm remembering that famous video of George R. R. Martin and Stephen King doing some talk or panel together. And Martin asks King, how do you write so fast? And Stephen King's like, yeah, you know, I try to write like 2,000 words a day. And that's kind of always been my thing. It's like when I'm working on something, I gotta get it out. I have to set myself a goal that is achievable, but you know, big enough that there's noticeable progress at the end of every day. And Martin is famously not a quick writer and also writes much denser stories than King does. But he's like, you mean you don't like write a sentence and then look at it and then feel bad about it and then delete it and wonder why you ever started to be a writer in the first place and like write a word and then like take a nap. And it's, you know, it's two very different and interesting ways of writing. Do you find that, I'll reword that. How do you write? You know, do you like sit alone in a quiet room with a laptop, or are you like writing ideas on your phone while chasing the kids around or whatever?
I usually maybe if the kids have gone to sleep, I'll try to write in the evening for a couple of hours. If I have any energy after work, I tend to kind of only really be able to write at the computer, maybe a few sort of notes down in the phone, or if I'm walking somewhere that can be, you know, maybe I'll write something down. But yeah, I really kind of, I don't have like a ritual. And especially I think, with one kid, I was maybe more productive in the sense of like, oh, I've only got this amount of time. And it's really like, what did I do with all the time I had before? Okay, I've really got to like not get so distracted or go on to other things. So it's helped in that sense of kind of maximizing the small amount of time do you get. But yeah, I tend to just be able to write. I can't write anything by hand. That's anytime I write by hand, it's like I just can't believe it's any gonna be any good.
Yeah. I don't know why. It's a whole different experience. Like neurologically, like it's activating different parts of your brain. Sometimes I'll get bored in a meeting and write some lines of poetry or something just to occupy myself, and I feel like you can tell if you look at something I've written by hand and then typed up versus something that I've written into the Google Doc. I feel like it's almost like it's two different people who have written these things. Which maybe for, you know, for experimental writers is like that's like a good idea to do something like that, write the same short story by hand and on the computer and then like shuffle them, interweave them so that there's some change of texture or something. I don't know.
It would be a great experiment to try and write something by hand, but I just don't think I'd be able to. I don't know. I just don't think I'd be able to stomach it. Some way it feels too personal for me, or like I need the feedback loop between like me and the screen, or the fact that it becomes sort of standardized in a way that it's not my sort of handwriting. I think in a way that it's a kind of psychological trick to make me think like, oh, it's not me doing this, or I think it some way it helps kind of remove also an element of kind of the critical. You know, if I write a line and I write it by hand, I'm gonna go, that is awful. I might write the same line on the computer and go, maybe there's something in here. I don't know.
That's a fascinating thought, the psychological disconnect. Interesting. My preference for keyboard over pen and paper has largely just been mechanical. I can type faster than I can write, and kind of in the same way that if I plot a story out, I don't feel the need to write it. If I've thought a sentence before I get it out of me for too long, then I'm no longer interested in the sentence. So it's like, you got to learn to type fast, bud. You got to figure it out. Like I used to play typing games at work just to get the words printed up, you know, just to know where the keys on the keyboard are and get things out of me quickly enough. Interesting.
My mom used to have one for secretary work. Green kind of green writing on the old computer screens. Mm-hmm. It beep if you pressed it.
Those were the days. Got to return to that. I've seen advertised on Instagram like essentially old school word processors, like very digital keyboards, marketed, you know, made in this day and age and marketed towards writers for it's like no distractions or whatever. Like, I'm not going to have my phone next to me while I'm working on my word processor. But it, you know, it's nice. I'm sure if like my mom got it for me for Christmas or something, I would try to use it. I think B.R. Yeager uses something like that, and his books are fantastic. So there's probably a point to it. I also suspect he and some of our other contemporaries use Elle Nash as an editor. I think she might have a lot to do with it too. I've been saying that for a little bit now too, that I think that she is a hidden force in a lot of indie lit. To that point, working with Whiskey Tit, what is that like? I don't think I've asked someone on the show, but I have a handful of Whiskey Tit books now through the show that I'm curious how working with that press is, especially editorially.
No, there's definitely some kind of editing, a lot of editing process. Like with the autodidacts, they had taken it on just at the point, you know, I'd had that book, it had been rejected for like 5 or 6 years or possibly even longer. And so I was just on the sort of verge of giving up hope with it. And I had just gone through like one last major sort of edit. So I had been through that book so many times that, you know, structurally it was kind of more or less there. And it was just a few kind of line edits. And then with How I Killed the Universal Man, I sort of sent it to Miette and we talked about it. And we were like, there's something. The ending was really a struggle to write with the book and the kind of getting the kind of balance between the final chapter and how that would interact with the things that had gone before and how it would make a kind of, how it would be sort of conceptually coherent without being too obscure. That took a lot of kind of, you know, quite a bit of back and forth and kind of reworking through it and angst on my part. I think they've been great to work with. I love Whiskey Tit and I love the books they're putting out. So I'm really happy to be with them at the moment. Everyone, and it's a really nice press to be a part of. You know, like a lot of the sort of Whiskey Tit writers, they kind of, we talk to each other or sort of support or send each other books and chat. So yeah, it's really nice. It's a really nice kind of label to be part of, label, bat press to be part of.
Yeah. Well,
and you had like Dave Fitzgerald on here for Troll and mm-hmm. David Leo Rice, no?
Yes.
They're so nice. They're like such good guys. I don't know.
Yeah. They are both, they were both incredibly fun to talk to. And I have David's new book, Leo Rice's new book, sitting on my shelf to be read.
It's so good.
So stay tuned. I'm very excited. I really enjoyed Oh, what was the last one he had?
A New House.
Yes, I really enjoyed that. In a lot of different ways. But I suppose his writing and your writing sort of could have a good dialogue together, since he's into the seedy kind of thing, where noir sort of has that idea too, that like, let's explore the underbelly. I remember hearing David on another podcast years ago where he was talking about the term seedy, which means that like, it implies that there's something there to grow, which I guess is kind of like in contrast to how I normally view noir, as like almost watching something that's overgrown starting to like see the decay of it, which I think that's why at least the American films that I've watched take place in LA or New York, because it's like there's just too much and it's starting to collapse under its own weight. And I think also why it's a perfect genre to start really reconsidering in the 21st century, because it's like kind of impossible to escape that like overgrownness.
Yeah, and I think I don't know if this is kind of what David was alluding to, or if it's the same similar idea, that you almost kind of, you want it to rot, right? That's the sort of start, that's the beginning of the kind of noir structures. So it's like you're drawn into something and then you start to witness the structure around it begin to kind of fester or rot, or whatever is kind of hidden is kind of revealed. And then sort of, you know, with any kind of notion of filth or things that are kind of abject, there's always that no idea of kind of something bacterial or something else that can kind of give way to a different kind of existence after, you know, after it implodes, after it's rotted, after it's become ash, although there's something that might emerge out of the primordial ooze of it or whatever.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. That makes sense to me. I've been thinking of the fungal for so long. Although I think I've been snapped out of it. Instagram has been feeding me a lot of like mushrooms are Jesus sort of thing lately. And I'm like, okay, all right, enough with the mushrooms. We gotta think of a different image. But that does make me curious if you have a sort of like preoccupation with a sort of like image that maybe doesn't like directly make it into your work, but is like kind of there in your brain.
Yeah, I mean, I think definitely usually there's some idea like that for each kind of book. So there's maybe a different image for the Autodidacts, which was to do with kind of proportionality and something kind of being hidden, or when you see the shadow of something in the water and not being able to tell, but still feeling something, and that working with the confusion. And then with How I Killed the Universal Man, because I was quite into trying to read sort of theory at the time, and kind of, you know, reading it very similarly to how I would read fiction, and, you know, not being sort of, I don't know, classically trained to read it and then having to read around it, and kind of, so I think with How I Killed the Universal Man, something I kind of like, I know it's gonna sound so pretentious, but like the Deleuzian idea of kind of the rhizome, and that idea of something that kind of can move in different directions at once, and how you alter particular elements that they can be kind of recoded, and how, you know, I think there's one chapter in A Thousand Plateaus where they talk about the face as being kind of overcoded, you know, like the face is too often used as like a way to kind of communicate feeling or emotion, and this has cheapened those, or has kind of had a negative effect on the ability to communicate. So you need to find different ways to express something, except, you know, not just through kind of the face or kind of mask, becomes instantly kind of evocative depending on the sort of structure around it. So yeah, I think that was a kind of image. And then I was also with kind of the stomata technology or kind of concept in the book. I was I read, what was I reading? Yeah, a lot about this, again, the kind of fungal thing and kind of trees and the way in which there's a kind of hidden communication. And always I was very fascinated with these initial paintings by, I've forgotten her name, a Spanish artist. I think on the front cover, the front cover may have an image from him, possibly. These kind of first drawings were kind of nerves and how, you know, the microcosmic seems to kind of mimic the macrocosmic, and those kind of things were, yeah, very much kind of on my mind when it came to writing it and to thinking about the set of imagery I kind of wanted to use. So I was always, one thing I really wanted to avoid in the book was any kind of imagery of depth, for instance, because, you know, the idea of kind of something being virtual means that it doesn't have depth or spatial qualities in that way. So I wanted to avoid things that would spatialize thoughts, if that makes sense, and to think about them instead in terms of kind of qualities. So those were the kind of images and then kind of conceptual rules that I wanted to have when it came to, you know, kind of metaphor and simile and all those kind of elements, which, you know, I tend to use quite a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting to me. One of the things about, I'm going to invent a new term, fungality. I think, and especially hearing you talk just now and thinking about another point I wanted to bring up is, you know, the idea of clones shows up in this book a lot. And I think goes back even to kind of how we started out talking about, like, the implication that the brain is not the self, that things happen to the brain to, like, inject emotions or thoughts into you, but, like, you can tell that it's happening. And so there's, you know, even if it's happening within the brain, right, there's a separation conceptually between, like, the mind and the brain. But, you know, with the idea of, like, a fungus, the idea that, like, you know, the mycelium of certain mushrooms can, like, connect roots of trees together so that the trees can communicate with each other and share resources and stuff. This idea that I guess shows up in, like, eco-poetics and Eastern philosophy, the idea of, like, the self is there, but it's not really there. And everything's kind of, like, yeah, spread out in this network, this web, that feeds information back to each other a lot.
Yeah, I think, and a lot of the book, or another aspect of the book that sort of drove it, was a kind of, yeah, maybe our sort of frustration that our species is not more fungal in a way, right?
Mm-hmm.
That there is a kind of the absence of, so I wanted to try, if, you know, if it's sort of an impossible to imagine, maybe what a different form of consciousness might look like, or a kind of hive consciousness or a fungal consciousness or these kind of things. And the kind of, when you think about those things, you start to sort of realize how poorly we actually deal with sort of abstraction or with kind of our interrelations with the world, or how limited we are in kind of really thinking about, you know, the reality of other people or other existences. And so there's a kind of frustration there that I think works its way through kind of a lot of my writing, for a desire for some kind of communication that both annihilates and sort of is fertile or allows for, like, new possibilities. Because, yeah, I think the structure of kind of human consciousness, or at least how it is at the moment, it doesn't you know, you see all the time, we know things, but they don't have like the ability, or we can't, very rarely do they kind of produce change, even if we are kind of aware. They just kind of this mounting anxiety or a mounting kind of, there's not the possibility of kind of the fluid interchange of the mycelium between trees, you know, that connection is severed or didn't exist or just is not species, you know, not within us at this point. I don't know. So that, yeah, there's a kind of, those aspects were really contrasting, I guess, within the novel in trying to think about them.
Yeah, an anxiety that I guess developed in me reading the book is this curiosity at how the nature of our sense of self will certainly change as the technology that influences us changes. And I'm trying to think of a good example, and it may be difficult because even as I was reading it, it was just one of those sort of like ambient waves that's just kind of like pushing on me, where as things get more interconnected, the idea that and with AI, like, how do I want to say it? I really want to say it in a way that's satisfying to how it feels, but it may be difficult. I feel like, and maybe this is obvious too, I feel like the way that how it feels to be a human, how it feels to be a person, is going to look radically different in a generation or two from how it does now. Which makes me wonder if it was different back then. I mean, you hear people all the time say something like, oh, we used to not think of ourselves as different from nature, or, oh, we used to see communities as an extension of the family or something. And it's like, well, I mean, I wasn't there, so I can't tell you if I agree with you or not. Certainly people behaved that way, it seems, from the archaeological evidence or whatever. But I feel like maybe I took for granted for a long time the idea of the human experience as a static point that we all share as like a reference object to connect us to each other. But the idea that is moving, what the human condition is moving, is mildly frightening.
I mean, I think for me, I think it's sort of the only, I don't know how to say this, for me, it's a hope, no? The hope that although kind of all signs culturally and, you know, within the sort of economic and faux democratic sort of society we live in, all signs seem to point towards pessimism, that a possibility of changing, or the possibility that, it won't necessarily be the same. I don't, for instance, I don't feel a kind of particular nostalgia for a kind of period of human community, but the community of the future, or the possibility of that, seems to me like something to hold onto, however it sort of, you know, might look, as long as it's not sort of a nightmarish scenario. I think I've always been, you know, I grew up in quite a sort of religious ground, you know, where sort of evolution was not sort of believed. I was very fascinated with the kind of the idea of what is it to evolve? What is that moment of evolution like? And I think I've mentioned this somewhere else before, but there was a book I read when I was a kid that was like a children's book called My Headmaster is an Alien or something like this. Mm. And it was very much about like this moment in which, you know, they realized, we were all meant to be sort of telepathic, but it was too agonizing. And so we sort of individualized in order to kind of shield ourselves, and we've never been able to heal from this or whatever. And I remember thinking, wow, that is like an incredible like concept. And it always kind of stayed with me. And so the notion of kind of evolution or being able to kind of become something different, even if it means kind of leaving something behind, I think. Yeah, that's why I think the novel probably escapes the trap of kind of nihilism. That's why, at least, I kind of what I hope. There are two elements in kind of the novel that I hope are play against the kind of, you know, more sort of, I don't know, quote unquote dystopian elements of it, which are kind of, there's a moral kind of decision at the end of the book, or a kind of ethical dilemma that has to be chosen. And this also this kind of notion that, you know, what comes next doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, the worst. I don't know.
Yeah, I do recall feeling kind of good at the end of reading it, thinking like, okay, yeah, there is, even in that world, there is a something that is trying to make things better, help us realize something, that yeah, like, you know, even through the video gamey bit at the end, kind of coming out of it, was nice. I wonder, I'm interested in the sort of shift to video game bit. I remember in that interview, the X-Ray interview that I referenced before, you talking about how you sort of started adding it video game elements, like dialogue options started showing up at some point, and then it got more and more and more until, as I've said before, shifts into second person for a while. I'm curious to hear you sort of explain again for me, like, the why of that. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, throughout the sort of, yeah, throughout the novel, the kind of, you know, one of the apps that is kind of made available to him is the options app that kind of gives you dialogue trees, which are a kind of reference to Fallout, which my wife used to play a lot. Mm. And I would kind of watch, and, you know, they sort of give you this one thing that came from sort of video games I was really interested in, was like, when you design your character, though, you have like the ability to make, if you put certain points in certain elements of the personality, they're able to ask more questions. And mm-hmm. so you get this kind of freedom, or the freedom to kind of move in the game is like a faculty of skill. And, you know, you can behave certain ways in the game with certain consequences. And those, and, you know, and it seemed to me that mixed with kind of what we were saying about, you know, big tech or big kind of data, where, you know, it'll start spamming you with fungal things if you've just sort of whispered it to yourself at 3 a.m. in the morning. Mm-hmm. And then you find on the thing. So that those things seem to kind of marry up quite sort of nicely, or to kind of work well. And then the shift into the video game, because it kind of centers around this idea of a kind of almost a sort of therapeutic, or a game that is a kind of test, the actual kind of trappings of where it's kind of set are, I guess, my attempt in a way to sort of reference, you know, sort of, I don't know, there's a part that's kind of quite costume drama-y. I mean, no, like it's set in kind of, you know, the game is set in sort of Victorian England or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it was the shift into the kind of you. I felt the you in that instance. I wrote that part before the novel had kind of finished, and I was like, I'm not sure, like, is this gonna work? How is this going to fit in? But it felt like it absolutely needed to be in there, and I needed to kind of figure out how to make the second person you. So when you are, you know, playing a game, you have that kind of avatar, or so I felt the you, shifting into the second person, again, it kind of allowed that sort of slight distancing effect, while at the same time paradoxically making it more personal. Then the game becomes the kind of conceptual retelling of the novel in another way, and it ends with, you know, a decision that doesn't perhaps immediately seem clear, but hopefully it represents the kind of the big ethical question of like, okay, which side are you going to go down? Are you going to affirm possibility even with, you know, the threat of what this thing is, or are you going to, you know, try to do something that is obviously kind of, I don't know, I'm not being clear, but yeah, the video game element, I think it was important in the sense of allowing a kind of questions about kind of agency and questions about how to achieve a kind of free will, or try to how sort of individualism and subjectivity are often kind of confused, and how often individualism is confused for freedom and subjectivity when really they're not necessarily that kind of related. I think I remember reading or listening to something where Lindsay Lerman was talking, and I think she was talking about Simone Veil, I don't know how you pronounce it. And, you know, after identities, once identity is gone, subjectivity kind of remains. And the identity, in a way, is a kind of inhibiting element, so the possibility of kind of assuming another identity, as you can with kind of games at times, as you do with kind of literature. So in a way, the video game is also kind of a substitute for kind of narrative. And when you read a book, you're kind of possessed by the book in a sense. You're playing, you know, you're playing with the language as it plays with you. So there's that interaction, that kind of freedom about how it makes you feel, what you give up to it, what you take from it. Yeah, so that's where it kind of comes in, I guess. Okay, so this is from chapter 3. It's called Equipmental Being. And this is just after Lakerman, who's the main character, has kind of received a new implant of some technology. Lakerman's attention is an arpeggio, and reality has certain possibilities of cadence. Lakerman is sat cross-legged on the floor of his flat, halfway through a glass of chocolate-flavored oat milk and with his mouth full of vegan cookies, when he becomes conscious of himself as a thing localized in space and time. For the past 5 hours, perception and reality have shifted sweetly through possible positions, surprising interchanges, ascending and descending in a complement of difference, undoing the glacial idea of any uniform moment. Fuck holism, Lakerman has fought in the better moments of whatever this is. It arrives to Lakerman's attention that he does not know how he got home or where these cookies have come from. He is not in the habit of buying cookies or drinking chocolate milk. Lakerman is, however, newly aware that the tradition of pairing milk and cookies at Christmas in the US dates back to the Great Depression, and that this tradition has its roots in Norse mythology and an attempt to curry favor with Odin by the leaving of species-specific treats for his eight-legged horse. He frowns. Lakerman, realizing in this moment that he does know how he came home, on public transport, quite normally, ears plugged with music, outwardly secure while internally hallucinating Santa riding a spider horse and holding a Depression-era pitchfork as a Wikipedia article on the origins of cookie and cream, disambiguation, was read out in a monotone by the ghost of his stepfather done up in period garb. He knows this is how he got home, but he has no memory of it, even if there are images attached to the thought. He'd also had a conversation with his editor at Donkey Wolf regarding a meeting tomorrow, the content of which he can't remember. Then he'd gone to the supermarket where he'd bought an enormous amount of food and drink. He can't explain it. It was like his existence had been radically split, one half compressed and edited into highlights, the other visualized data guided by impulse, as if the self had been in two places at once. Evidently, he thinks, there has been a reaction between the residual noumenon in his system and the implant, resulting in some kind of associative fritzing that's fucking with his temporality. To the right of Lakerman, a brand name bottle of gin he can't afford is chilling in a bowl of perma ice. He reaches to look at its label. Something stops him. If he wants to stay here, he realizes, he has to concentrate. He reaches again for the gin, but grasping it, he's already gone. Lakerman stands behind a bar in Italy over 2 centuries ago. That's just the environment, a referential caption, preloaded knowledge, an unquestioned given. There's wood and peasants for period detail, and that's it. A military man of high social ranking asks for a cocktail, a Milano Torino or Americano. Lakerman is about to add soda water when the soldier's hand stops him. Pianoforte, the soldier says, something stronger. Lakerman picks up a bottle of gin. Like this, Lakeman learns, the Negroni is born. Something stronger. He is in the room again. The cookies have been finished, crumbs vacuumed. The oatmeal glass is gone, rinsed clean in the sink behind him. At his feet is a sepia-colored Negroni with a pornographic amount of condensation wetting the glass. He takes a sip. It's bitter like the past, and yet some syrupy aspect coats his mouth thick with promise. Lakeman is watching a stand-up routine on YouTube and has been for the last half an hour. Surprisingly, he can recall it all despite his hallucinatory history lesson. The comic delivers a show written by an AI's attempt to mimic the comic's own observational style. That was the through-line joke. The disjunction between one grasping off-kilter view of the world and another. Lakeman wakes up to find himself in his bathroom. He is scrubbing the sink and the toilet has been recently bleached. The cubicle around him blooms with chemical flowers. There are cultures of life in the cracks of his wall, and he feels their blind struggle and the satisfied discharge of their energy expended in replication. Lakeman scrubs so hard a bubble escapes the brush. He pushes his finger into the soap bubble. It indents and floats away. He thinks, surface tension equals non-violent resistance. Gandhi appears in the reflection of the tap. He polishes Gandhi's glasses, the hot tap. H for Heidegger. Images of Gandhi intermingle with footage of Heidegger. Lakeman deep fakes his own imagination, begins to put together what he imagines is shareable content. He calls it When Gandhi Met Heidegger. Gandhi tells Heidegger it's obvious Nazism is latent in Heidegger's thought. Heidegger wants to protest. It's a possibility of his thought, he concedes, but not intended and certainly not obvious or a consequence of it. Ask for forgiveness, Gandhi says. I can't, replies Heidegger. I'm dead. I'm no longer being in the world. Also, you are like really a Nazi, Gandhi says. For realsies. That was the me of the they. I should never have entered the marketplace. I belonged in the mountains with the peasants living beyond politics. Look at what I could think, what I did. You overrate both beauty and its proof. You might have been kinder, but you are an arrogant prick. It doesn't matter what you romanticize, only that you do romanticize. Romanticizing the death of another. Fuck off, Gandhi. Lakeman gains consciousness next to his mini oven. He is beginning to feel nauseous. There are many voices inside of him now. What identifies itself as his own voice is detectable only by its disjunction, a noticeably off note in the swell of possibility. The other voices keep whispering options, statistics, outcomes, and desires, but nothing feels tangible enough to fill the blind spot where he ought to be. Lakeman feels a mounting panic. An impulse that isn't his commands his body to breathe, and his body responds. Lakeman is breathing slowly and deeply, and his attention is with his breath, his existence in this moment. He is breathing as if in a meditation, but Lakeman is not in a meditation, and among the settling calm and the alteration of his detuning brave waves, a panic, only able to state itself, skates atop the deepening peace. His thoughts feel taxidermy, detangled and glazed, the language he used to articulate the world around him a kind of phantom limb, a referential memory he can only experience in absentia. He struggles against the tide of wellness, the release of serotonin, the jags of optimism. Lakeman begins to worry that he's become a living memorial to himself, a fully mathematizable thing siphoned into another, larger and unknowable thing within which he'll accrete in the saddest of ways. He is telling himself he is worrying, but he cannot experience this worry physiologically. He thinks this intervention on the part of the implant chances a partial corruption of his thought, that he won't be able to remember his real thoughts, the original fading from the denaturing exposure, and that after a while his thoughts would come to occupy a kind of flattened terrain as they lost their architecture, leaving him alone with experiences deboned and frameless, so that the sense of self embodied in them would become haunted, lost in the limitlessness of their flat distribution. Lakeman forces himself to cry, and the room trembles with a strangely insincere weeping. ¶¶